Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg just before 6 p.m. before we cross back to the Bafana Bafana game. The markets rarely ask whether something is good or bad, only whether it's better or worse than expected. I'm Jim Muyaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest out of the Financial Action Task Force gathering that is taking place in Paris at the moment. We are in our mutual evaluation period that is set to run until towards the end of next year, so probably October, November of 2027. We speak to the Financial Intelligence Center around that, get a sense of what it is that's in focus from a country perspective and what we need to be getting right. Then we have a conversation as well with the team at Standard Bank taking a look at the Africa Energy Forum and what we can make of the developments happening there. We also have a conversation from a small business perspective, taking a look as part of our SME of the week at a company called Plato Coffee, a company we all know very, very well and have seen around. The company has been doing exceptionally well. We speak to its co-founder and CEO, Stefan Bredel, around how that business was built with his brother and what that business looks like today.
The day's markets. Understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
And that's where we kick off the show, with a sense of market movements and what's been happening in the markets throughout the day. Joined on the line by independent analyst Terence Hove to take a look at markets and see what to make of them. Terence, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. I suppose let's start our conversation with the Fed rates decision that took place yesterday. The rate decision itself unchanged, but the interest rate projections going into the second quarter of the year and beyond, now with the dot plot suggesting that we could potentially be in for some rate hikes out of the US. What do you make of that?
Yeah, good evening, Jimmy.
Just before we lost you, we were taking a look at the interest rate decision out of the US. Nothing happening from a decision perspective, but the dot plot suggesting that we are in for rate hikes in the US under the new Fed chair.
Yeah, and I think that last point that you made, Jimmy, is really what the market is pricing in, the new Fed chair. And leading into Kevin Warsh's nomination, that was the expectation, or rather what the market started pricing in, a very hawkish Fed in comparison to Jerome Powell. And that's where the comparison was as well, especially in that President Donald Trump was rather favoring a more dovish Fed. As you recall, he used to send out comments quite a bit on U.S. Fed Jerome Powell on his aggressive rate hikes at some point. So now, with the new Fed chair being seen and perceived as a hawk, that's what we're seeing the market starting to price in the expectation that going into the next coming meetings, the U.S. Fed is likely to increase interest rates. And if we look at the current economic backdrop, we also have quite, that elevated inflation driven by energy costs. Of course, the oil prices started coming down, given, the recent peace deal that has been pinned down. However, that will take time to really filter through into the market. But as it stands with the current, high inflation, as we're seeing, especially locally as well, the expectation or, pricing in going into the rest of 2026 is that there's a possibility that the new U.S. Fed chair is likely going to be very hawkish when it comes to interest rate decisions. And that's the play that we're seeing there. And we're seeing that playing out in the, rally in the U.S. dollar. That's what the market is pricing in. And our South African rand is fed pretty well, given that dollar pressure and that dollar rally that we've seen on that, future rate hike expectations from that dot plot, given the new Fed chair that's now in office.
Terence, let's take a look at that oil price. $76 a barrel. The last time we were here was at the start of March. It's been four very long months, including this one, very painful months. I'm looking at a chart right now on my screen, and if we dip into the 75s, back down to the 70s, it will be the first time since February of this year that we get to that. Certainly, this peace deal could not have come at a more at a better time, at a much needed time, but very, very evident in how the market has been behaving that the market is finally relieved that we are at this point.
Yes, I think we're all relieved we are finally at this point, and may oil keep going lower for the sake of the fuel prices that we've seen that have been, you know, pretty high locally. Just looking at it from our local perspective, and if we look even in how our South African Reserve Bank has responded, you know, to that fight against inflation. However, the peace deal is pinned down, and we hope that it stays in place because as we've seen with such situations, it's so fickle. The deal can be pinned down, you know, within a week's time. There could be an aspect of the deal that has been, you know, violated, or, you know, Iran might see the U.S. not honoring a certain aspect of the deal in time, in the timelines that they've said that they should. So I think right now, given all of this optimism, I think generally investors, market participants out there should really look at the finer detail. And I think either party is going to be watching carefully if the tenants of the deal are going to be honored in the timelines, especially that they've been, you know, placed. Because then if there's a delay in a particular aspect of the deal, that could well see a rally back, you know, in the price of oil. So oil remains volatile because I think with the current backdrop around that situation, it remains a very fragile kind of, you know, play out, especially in honoring the tenants of the deal. So very happy to see it come back, even happier seeing oil going much lower than $77 a barrel, but still wary in terms of, you know, the tenets of the deal being honored as we go into 2026. At least for now, we know the Strait of Hormuz is open. There's been a few ships that have sailed through, and we hope that remains the case. And what is also essential around that is the military presence on either side around the Strait of Hormuz. For as long as they remain there, which is likely, I think there's a possibility that, you know, the escalation could, you know, or that geopolitical escalation could flare up at any moment. So that is something to always keep watching very closely.
Terence, let's take a look at equity markets. They're also having a bit of a mixed reaction to what's been happening and what's been unfolding. The FTSE in London in the red, other European markets in the green, Asian markets all in the red except the Nikkei in Tokyo, that was in the green. US markets are in the green, our markets are in the red. What do we make of what's happening on the equities front? It seems like it's a bit of an up and down situation. And I'm looking at the most recent equity that's been all of the hype and hubbub in the form of SpaceX. That listed relatively well. But as we look at it now, I just want to see where we're sitting at the moment. We listed at 135. We're back at 180. But the share price is trading down on the day, having gone above $200 a share. What do you make of what's happening in the equities world?
Yeah, I think we'll start off with the SpaceX story. I think that has been a remarkable, as you said, spot on. It's been a successful listing. Listing can be very, very tricky. You know, it just plainly saying it is some successful or nearly as successful. So when you see an equity or a listing, an IPO at 135, it goes all the way to 200, comes back at 180. That still does exceedingly well. I mean, it's signaling very strong demand. And I think what we're also seeing is the big appetite around what we could say Elon Musk stocks. because I think that the market is starting to really see a lot of the vision that many years ago wasn't so clear, or it, at some point, was a joke, if we could be honest, that why would he venture into a space that he is not an expert in? But here we are today, and you look at that successful IPO. And then when we look at that mixture of different geographical location of the Bowsers, I think what we're also seeing right now is the different regions pricing in the various risks. In particular, how, you know, the geopolitical risk in the Middle East is a very big driver of sentiment at the moment. So pricing that risk well is going to be very important for traders and investors globally. And mispricing that could cost trillions of dollars as well. So I think what we're seeing now is investors really carefully coming into the market and measuring the optimism as we're seeing across. If we look at, for example, the commodity space, that has done exceedingly well, because commodities have been a very big gauge of sentiment. When we look at, gold, for example, of that risk is coming out of the market. We're seeing those prices coming lower. So it's a mixture of that global outlook. And of course, with energy comes the inflation link. And with inflation, then comes the interest rate play. What are central banks likely going to do in the rest of 2026? So that becomes a very important aspect to price in well, especially in the rates market, which ultimately affect everything else in financial markets. So we're seeing that playing out in markets at the moment, and that is the mixture and sentiment that we're seeing. The risk appetite is back. There's risk on, given the de-escalation of the Middle East and the peace deal that's there. However, the outlook, because it's still going to take time for that oil to flow well into the market, for prices to really come down immediately when we speak of fuel prices as well. And then again, the inflation adjustments, which then ultimately will then speak to the interest rate moves from the various central banks. So that is the sentiment and the mix of sentiment that we're seeing playing out in the market at the moment.
Markets are trying to make sense of all the things unfolding around them and how to price these movements. We'll see how markets respond and react as the days go on, and whether or not we can finally put the Middle East tensions behind us, at least this phase of those. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Independent analyst Terence Hove joining us. Take a look at markets and what seems to be driving them.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The ongoing mutual evaluation period for South Africa has commenced, and this will obviously run until to the latter part of next year. What this, of course, means for South Africa is that we need to be ensuring that we are continuously meeting the obligations of the Financial Action Task Force that we promised we would do to get ourselves off of the grey list. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the Executive Manager for Compliance and Prevention at the Financial Intelligence Centre Unit, Christopher Malani. He joins me on the line now to see what is unfolding here. Christopher, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. You're currently in Paris at a FATF gathering. Give us a sense of what's happening there and why South Africa is there in this particular week.
Thank you, Jimmy, and thank you for the opportunity, and evening to your listeners. South Africa is a member of the Financial Action Task Force, long-standing member since 2003. And we attend three meetings a year for the FATF plenary. And this is the June meetings. There are meetings in February, June, and October. At each meeting, the FATF deals with a range of issues, but most importantly for the purpose of our discussion, mutual evaluation reports. So this year, I've just come out of discussions as one of the article country interrogators of the report. We covered the report of Canada and the report of Takeya today. And the lessons learned from that gives South Africa a good sense of where the international scrutiny and level of debate is on all elements of compliance, which leads us in fantastically to how we are stacking up to prepare for our own mutual evaluation.
Let's take a look at that mutual evaluation, Christopher. We were just removed off the grey list in October of 2025. The last thing we want to do is not ensure that we adhere to the promises we made to the Financial Action Task Force and find ourselves back in a precarious position. Where do we currently stand as South Africa, and what do we need to be focusing on here?
Well, South Africa is very much in execution phase. Just as an interesting aside, the mutual evaluation report of Tukaya was discussed this week. And they were grey listed just before us, if you can recall, and came off the grey list. So it was very much a discussion that gave due acknowledgement to all the good work and improvement that country had done. And similarly, South Africa now needs to build on the foundation, the strong intergovernmental foundation we had put in place to exit the grey list. We now need to take the bar increasingly higher. And in that context, we as the FIC are raising a concern with our recent media release that we need industry and businesses to be our partner and to cooperate with us.
Christopher, when we speak of industry, can we take a look at perhaps where some of the industry participants rank and stand at the moment? We know that from a monitoring perspective, especially if we look at the area of anti-money laundering, terror financing, there are specific reporting requirements that need to come through from everyone from crypto asset service providers to casinos to trusts to standard company service providers. Where do we stand on a matter like that?
Okay, so let me go back to grey listing. When we were put into grey listing, the FIC was charged with key deliverables. And the first one of the key deliverables was to ascertain a risk appreciation, a profile in a sense of each and every entity that we supervised. We had to put in place a system to evaluate that, and that became then the 2023 risk and compliance return. And that enabled us, after we had engaged with industry, to gather sufficient information to make decisions regarding supervision, including identifying the higher risk entities and then putting in place measures to monitor and inspect them. Similarly now, with our 2026 risk and compliance submission process, we've now moved on 3 years. The questionnaire is tighter, and this for now is our most critical request to industry. There are two tranches of sectors. The tranche that is coming up for closure by 30th of June, and that's why we're concerned, it's less than 12 days away, are the crypto asset providers, as you've mentioned. It is the trust service providers, the company service providers, credit providers that are not banks, and then the casinos. They constitute our first reporting group. And so we are concerned that tranche is not seemingly engaging with our questionnaire and submitting to a level that gives us any comfort. And you would have seen from our media release, on average, we're looking at 12% of these specified accountable institutions that have made the time to file with us, and there are 12 days to go.
Christopher, what is the danger here if we are not compliant? We know that from a grey listing perspective, we've already seen what it's like to be on that list. It's the last thing we want to do is end up back on that list. But what is the danger here, especially during a mutual evaluation period, if we are not adhering to the promises that we made?
Well, the danger is simply put in the language of the Financial Action Task Force. It is incumbent upon the country's supervisors. And here the Financial Intelligence Center is the prime supervisor for non-banks, businesses and professions. We need to have information at hand to make certain key determinations and decisions about profiling each and every entity within each sector. So that is why, for now, in the absence of credible input data that we would receive through the submission of the returns, it obviously prevents us from having a good-sized population. 9 out of 10 is, and more is ideal, which means we should be getting 90% of the sectors responding on time. And we then analyze that information and then put it through our risk engines. And that then enables us to risk rank these entities and to make then supervisory decisions. In the absence of that, we will not be able to demonstrate with any credible systematic basis that we know, we understand, and can identify our higher risk entities, like which are our higher risk lawyers and estate agents in each sector. So that goes to the heart of the FATF methodology. It starts with us being able to our risk identify, because the FATF says we then, because we have limited resources, no supervisor has enough resources, we must then apply our limited resources where the greater risk lie. And that is through the identification process, which starts with the RCR submission that we are so concerned about.
Christopher, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the enforcement side of things from a FIC perspective. The Financial Intelligence Centre, as you mentioned, is the respective body responsible for monitoring the promises that we made at FATF. From your perspective, if the institutions, the various parties, whether they be the casinos, whether they be other sector institutions, those that are within the remit of the Financial Intelligence Center to monitor, if they are not compliant, what are we looking to do to either help them along with compliance or to ensure that they do not put South Africa in a precarious position?
Okay, no, thank you, Jimmy, for that's an excellent question. I mean, so what has the FIC done, right? Very importantly, we have, when we started the process, issued immediately what we called a draft public communication. It went out under number 125. And in essence, that was the questionnaire. So we gave industry way up front, weeks ago, sight of what the form is they would have to comply. We went through an additional process to say, look, this is our questionnaire. Are there any? And then we released it for consultation, not to change the form necessarily, but to clarify areas where people were not uncertain. So if people were raising concerns about they don't quite understand this concept, we could then, through guidance, clarify it. And now we've issued that clarifying guidance recently. So now there's a full suite of material available, and we've been holding extensive webinars with industry to take them through the form, to take them through our approach as to how they build the data. And by the way, on the cost side of it, we're very conscious about impact on time and cost for entities. They should have this data. It's a matter of if they've kept reasonable records, they should be able to collate the information like we all have to do for tax year. The information is there. We need to collate it and then present it in the format that the questionnaire requires. So, Jimmy, if it's not done, we very, very reluctantly go then into enforcement mode. But it's not enforcement mode necessarily to penalize. We have three targeted approaches. We go and target the sectors that are not responding well. We will have more webinars, number one. Number two, we will then also have inspections or reviews to get to understand what is the problem. And but then thirdly, our third is then to start the enforcement process. Another approach we take is if you've not filed your return by the due date, which is 30th of June, you will be considered and deemed to be high risk, which automatically puts you through your own non-compliance into the pool of entities we will scrutinize more closer. So those are the three responses we have in place. And that set of responses, we had a similar set of responses for the FATF grey listing. And that was well received by the FATF, that methodology we applied.
Ensuring that South Africa remains protected and in line with global standards on anti-money laundering and terror financing, the team at the Financial Intelligence Centre currently getting some useful and critical insights from the Financial Action Task Force gathering taking place in Paris at the moment. We look forward to seeing how they bring those insights back to South Africa and to South African businesses. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Christopher Malan, Executive Manager for Compliance and Prevention at the Financial Intelligence Center Unit, joining us to take a look at ongoing compliance and monitoring as South Africa enters its next mutual evaluation period.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So with the World Cup taking place and all of the streaming services online at the moment to catch all of the action, I thought we'd take a look at just some of the streaming offerings that are out there at the moment. DStv has, of course, got that free video streaming package that they've got, but it seems that has shrunk to just four channels being offered. At the same time, the likes of MTN are looking to launch their own streaming service to challenge Netflix. For more on this, we're going to take a look at... Oh, I'm joined on the line by our resident digital expert Hanu Labaskakhni of My Broadband to see if we can make sense of this. Hanu, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. The streaming world clearly a buzz at the moment, not just from some of the operational challenges or changes that are taking place, but events like the World Cup taking place in the United States definitely bring about a lot more interest in streaming and access so that people can watch the games and revisit and relive all of this. How's streaming streaming faring now with this World Cup?
It's been a very, very interesting development. And yeah, good evening to you as well, Jimmy. It's a big pleasure. Especially with this World Cup, we've seen a bunch of platforms come to the fore for the first time. This one example, I think, is Sporty TV, which is owned by a sports betting company that's come in and has this offer of you pay 15 Rand for a subscription to the entire World Cup, and you can watch it on YouTube. I think directly with them, it's something like 10 Rand. And then also, I think MultiChoice, very keenly aware of the extra competition, they made it available on their cheaper plans, their cheaper packages, the Access and Family plans for the first time, all 104 live matches of the World Cup on those more affordable packages. So I think it was keenly aware of this. And we saw, despite, you know, all these other players coming on board and it being available everywhere, the SABC Plus also, they broadcast, well, streaming all of the Bafana games and a bunch of other games, about 34 in total, they said, of the World Cup. Even their platform fell over with that first game. They had a little bit of a issue there, but yeah, it was due to some update on FIFA's side, which made things a bit hairy in the start. But certainly the market is opening up wide, and we're seeing it around big events, especially in terms of sports coverage, where, you know, DStv previously was the go-to platform. We've seen these a bunch of competitors in this space. And so giving South Africans a way more affordable way to catch some of the most sought-after sports events.
Hanu, let's take a look at the focus now from a streaming platform perspective. If you're a streaming service provider looking to come into the market, like the new ones that have come in for the World Cup, do you then start to think about things as an event-based model where you're only coming in for certain events and then after that you don't stream anything or you disappear or you do less work? How does this now fundamentally reshape how we think about subscription services, especially towards live events?
So, yeah, this model, I think the model you're referring to is basically pay-per-view, is one of those. In the US, it's a very, very popular where people basically just pay for access to a specific event, a sports event, instead of like a consistent subscription over a long time. And I think month-to-month subscriptions have sort of conditioned the South African market for these things. The one area where we haven't seen something like this for the first time, the Sporty TV one, is a good example, where instead of having their own streaming platform, they also do have one, but instead of doing that, they run on YouTube's platform, which is a very established, and they're really good with live events already. We've seen Netflix try a few live events and things went a bit wrong there. So I definitely think it's a trend we're moving towards, where, you know, South Africans in general, we like to save money. And I think one of the clear signs of this was as well with this first Bafana game, that the DStv website, not the streaming website, but the actual website on which you get a subscription, was offline due to the significant volume of traffic they saw on the night. And it's so typical for me with South Africans, where everyone was trying to save as much money. You want to give DStv as little money as possible, so you subscribe at the last moment. So I certainly think like this model that Sporty TV is using, you know, and it's very interesting. They're almost like they're a sports betting company, and all of the advertising it goes towards, it's basically just for them on the platform. But you see so much sports betting advertising on DStv and other platforms anyway, that it's not really that much of a nuisance. I've personally subscribed to this as my preferred way to watch it, because I feel that YouTube is a very reliable platform. And I think if this is a success for them, it definitely sets the stage for more of these types of, you know, one-off event subscriptions, especially with South Africans being as price sensitive as they are.
Hanu, does it not also then open up the opportunity for the smaller players? I mean, traditionally, we know the big players, we know the super sports, we know the Netflixes. Depending on what you want, there are those established brands. But then does that not mean there's an opportunity here for the lesser known brands, the more private label brands, so to speak, to come into a market and say, well, we've secured access to this particular sport, you might like that, and you can pay-per-view for that?
So it is incredibly difficult. The world of sports rights and live broadcasting, it's incredibly expensive. If you look at the company backing the sporty TV service, they've probably got very deep pockets out of the UAE. And it's not easy to just offer that, just like, you know, just come in and disrupt DStv or MultiChoice or Canal Plus, its new owner. It's a very experienced company in the area of sports rights, and it's keenly aware of the value of these rights. I think with the FIFA World Cup and football in general, it's been a little bit more open. DStv has been more open. But I don't think we'll see anytime soon, you know, coverage of Springbok games, for example, or some of the more short, well, it's sort of like perceived as sports that are for more affluent households, that you'll see those, some of these golf tournaments and things like that being on alternative platforms. I think Canal Plus is keenly aware of super sports value. They've said this themselves. I think the one thing that they were willing to sacrifice was the Winter Olympics was one thing that we unfortunately couldn't get anywhere. I think they probably just looked at the metrics of the Winter Olympics compared to some of their other events, and they were like, yeah, it's not incredibly popular among South Africans. It doesn't justify the price tag and the commercial potential. But I do think things like Springbok games and in that area, unless we've seen some regulatory movements, some pushing for more public broadcasting access or sub-licensing to be more open. But I don't think it's something that the DStv will easily surrender without a fight. I mean, this is what keeps people on DStv Premium. So unfortunately, in that area, it might be a bit of a bit difficult. But we've seen, I think Amazon Prime is a good example of a major disruptor, you know, 59 Rand per month for a streaming service and then all those shopping benefits. It's not completely unimaginable that the big players will come in and try to disrupt with sort of like once-off pay-per-view stuff, because companies like Amazon and Netflix have also got very, very deep pockets. So we might see more choice in that area.
Consumer choice might be the reason why it's a race to the bottom for some of these companies. We'll see how this unfolds. For now, streaming taking on many different forms as the World Cup continues to unfold. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Hanu Labuschagne of My Broadband joining us to take a look at the streaming world, the streaming services available, and how it is that those dynamics are changing.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by the Standard Bank Group. The Africa Energy Forum is currently underway in South Africa, in Cape Town. It has been running since Youth Day, and it is focusing on pragmatic and diversified energy solutions that would aim to support industrialization in South Africa and on the African continent. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the head of project finance in energy and infrastructure at Standard Bank Corporate and Investment Banking, Cheryl Byrne. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of this week. Cheryl, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. The Energy Forum is an important part of the energy conversation that has been ongoing for quite some time, especially when we look at things around the renewable sector and we look at things around just energy transition endeavors from our own perspective as a country. What has been the focal point of this year's gathering?
Thanks very much for having me. So this year's gathering is about Africa's industrialized future. And so what's really great is South Africa, from a renewable energy and power point of view, has been very active in the market over the last few years. But we're starting to see an emerging theme of other African countries joining in the generation, need for new generation, and a lot of that coming from renewable energy technology. So it's quite an exciting conference.
Cheryl, which of the markets on the African continent are showing signs of growth, and what are some of the differences between these markets and perhaps other markets that might lead or that might point to where that growth is coming from?
So the markets that are definitely pumping at the moment are South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Zambia. A lot of activity in Zambia, and we're also seeing a lot of activity maybe moving across into DRC. The reason why these markets are so important and the ingredients that are making them very active is linked to open access. So open access is where you can not just buy power from the utility, but you can also buy power from private sector players. And that's changed the landscape and the speed at which projects can be done in these markets. The other thing that's quite important to understand is these are markets with high energy needs, given the mining operations that are happening in those countries. And DRC and Zambia in particular, in copper and cobalt, those are critical minerals that are very important for the industrialized future of Africa. And so we're seeing a lot of expansion and need for energy, and with open access and them as key energy drivers, a lot of activity is happening.
Cheryl, as South Africa, we've had conversations, particularly from an Eskom perspective as the official power supplier in the country, around unbundling Eskom and increasing our transmission capabilities and capacities in South Africa, and perhaps broadening beyond that. How important is transmission capacity in these renewable conversations? Because at some point or another, any of the energy and any of the electricity we're generating, whether renewable or otherwise, does need to have infrastructure that supports it.
Yes, correct. Transmission is critical, and it's going to be the new bottleneck that we see. So even in South Africa, there's a lot of renewable energy projects that are not able to happen because we're waiting for Eskom to launch the transmission project. But elsewhere across the African continent, as more generation comes onto the grid, we can't forget the need for transmission to be done, investment in transmission, because it's a critical factor and also part of the regional integration. The system, the Southern African power pool system, only operates well when there is transmission capacity across the countries. And so although a lot of focus is still on generation, I think the new focus going to be going forward is about how to unlock transmission capacity and how to ensure grid stability, particularly as renewables are added on, which adds its own challenge. But that can also be dealt with partially through battery energy storage. So we're seeing a lot of battery energy storage projects come through, but you still need that transmission infrastructure. And that's the emerging theme.
Cheryl, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the other conversations and other themes that are coming up at the Africa Energy Forum. It is, of course, still ongoing. And as it wraps up, what are some of the key takeaways that we're looking to get out of this and potentially looking to implement, not just in South Africa, but on the African continent?
I think the key takeaways from the Africa Energy Forum is around how private power can mobilize and quicken the timelines to generation. It's about the key role that energy traders can play in South Africa and across the continent in bridging that energy deficit gap, and the role of battery and transmission and how that's going to help unfold the future of the energy ecosystem across the continent.
Transforming Africa's energy landscape and ensuring that we build a sustainable future for Africa and her people. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Head of Project Finance in Energy and Infrastructure at Standard Bank Corporate and Investment Banking, Cheryl Byrne, joining us to take a look at the Africa Energy Forum taking place this week. What is in focus there, and what priorities are out there for energy on the continent? This feature was brought to you by the Standard Bank Group.
Sure, it's great knowing my net worth's denominated in dollars, euros, pounds, and rands. But that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. This is surprising my bro in the States on his birthday.
Surprise! It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get an offshore account with 4 currency options and pay no monthly maintenance fees. Search Standard Bank Private for more. Standard Bank, it can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
SME of the Week is powered by Capitec Business Banking. Start out or scale up with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply. It is SME of the Week time, and we get to showcase businesses that do well for themselves and spotlight those businesses to you, our SAFM community. Now, today's small business is a business that many of you may have come across because they opted for a franchising model at one point or another, and that has done exceptionally well for them. For those that haven't come across it, today will be your first time and hopefully not your last time. Joined on the line by the co-founder and chief executive officer at Plato Coffee, Stefan Bredal, to take a look at his business and how he built it. Stefan, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. In South Africa, with all of the businesses that are out there, with the Seattles and the Starbuckses of the world coming into the South African market, what made you start Plato Coffee?
Yeah, I think what happened is I started a coffee shop at a corporate, and then I saw, I think there's a gap for almost to bring coffee to the people in a way. So to the communities, to the workplaces, to the schools, universities. Because a lot of the times, like some of the big establishments, you know, you have to go into a mall, you know, to go to access them. So we said, listen, why not take coffee to the communities where people already live, around schools, etc. So we saw a bit of a gap there. And also on like underserved communities, like especially the smaller towns where the bigger brands weren't, we thought like there's definitely a gap to go play there. And that's why we're focusing on a lot of smaller towns like Tzaneen and Worcester and Streysbaai and Stilbaai. So where the bigger brands aren't, we saw a big opportunity there, and that's why we started it.
Stefan, I've seen the inside of a Plato store, and it looks different to kind of the bigger corporates that you might be competing with. What was your thinking here from a business model perspective? How did you craft your modular solution so that you can put it in the small towns, but also if you need to make it a bigger store, you're able to do that?
Yeah, so I think from the beginning we said we want to create the iStore of coffee shops, which, because if you're, whether you're an Apple fan or not, it's very aspirational when you walk into a shop. So we almost felt like all of this, the brands went like the very like dark wood and very cozy feeling. We said, listen, let's just go complete opposite direction to also differentiate ourselves. So we went with the South Korean, Japanese inspired design. But obviously when you have like this very clean, minimal shops, a lot of the time the people's first impression is, oh, it's so clean, meaning like double meaning, like clean aesthetically, but also it's clean. When you've got white counters, you have to keep it clean. And obviously when you're dealing with food and beverage, it's a nice first impression when people walk into a store, it's like clean. It's almost got like a lab feel. Yeah, and we went that route because obviously it was very differentiating to the other brands. Yeah. So then what happens then is you create this, call it aspirational, you open the shop, which is very clean, very iStore-like in a small town, and it creates that very, like, call it big city feel in a way, upmarket brand in a smaller town. Yes, that's the reason.
Stefan, let's take a look at the expansion of the business, deciding on how to build out the business, whether it's a franchising model, getting more stores in more locations. That is a capital intensive exercise. And most recently, you opened up a branch in London. Take me through that journey. Yes. And kind of how you saw this playing out, how it's worked out in South Africa and what you're taking. Yes. With you to London.
Yeah, it's a good question. So from the beginning, yeah, we bootstrapped. It was literally me and my brother, Pietro. So we initially debt financed all our shops up until about shop number 7, 8. And then we couldn't borrow any more money. So what ended up happening was we decided, okay, we want a franchise. And why do we franchise? So you could grow your brand without taking on extra risk, right? And so at that point, we decided, okay, because at point like shop 8, we got a lot of franchise requests. And then we decided, well, we can't open more shops of our own because we literally can't borrow any more money. And that was why we opted for the franchise route. So yeah, then we grew the franchise network. We're about 150 shops now. But we've got a very specific franchise owner-operator model. So you as a franchisee, you need to be the manager also in your shop. So you're not allowed to just call it invest in a shop and just put a manager in, because we believe coffee's got a lot of relational capital. So when people know the owner, the shops just, they do better. Recently opened London, and also same model. More recently, we started opting for like a JV model where we own 51% of the call it the trading entity, and then we'll get a franchisee, owner operator who owns the other 49. And then, so that's how we also set up UK. So that's for us a sweet spot. Initially, we started just corporate, then went completely franchise. But now we found that the JV model works really well, where we pay the franchisee a management fee, they pass royalties, and then we basically split the profit. So that's really a model that's been working very well for us.
Stefan, what would you say has been the biggest challenge in scaling a business to 150 stores? I imagine, as you said, the first eight, first seven were done bootstrapped. That was a good model. And at 150 stores, at some point, you start to think about the business differently. You start to think about your operations differently. What would you say for you now is the biggest challenge, but also potentially the biggest benefit of having the Plato brand?
Yeah, so I think the biggest with like exponential growth, like we had, was your infrastructure. It does put strain on that. So I think the biggest thing is to just keep like the infrastructure. Like for instance, the roastery. I mean, that is, we just bought a 70-kilogram roaster, and we immediately had to buy another one now that's coming end of the year, because the biggest challenge is to keep up with the growth, right? From an infrastructure point of view. So I think that's by far the, because we've done the franchise network approach, you almost got like a decentralized, call it management in a way, because you've got dedicated hands-on operators in each. So from a ops point of view at store level, that's not a massive issue, but it was really to keep up the infrastructure, to keep up with the growth. That was probably the biggest challenge. Yeah.
Stefan, if somebody's out there listening to you saying they want to be part of the Plato family, how does that work? What does that look like at the moment for you? You touched on the fact that you've got a bit of a hybrid model going on at the moment. How do people get involved with the Plato business?
Yeah, so first off, is to go on our website and fill in the application form. We do have a bit of a waiting list there, and we're all currently closed for the year because we have to open another about 42 shops this year still. So we don't have capacity to open more shops this year. But I mean, if you go online, you fill in the application form, there's going to be probably 70 spots open next year. We're not going to, even though we can grow quicker than that, because there's enough interest, call it, from on the waiting list. We made a decision to rather keep it cool. Yeah, it's maybe still not, people will say it's not steady, but for us, like between 50 and 70 shops a year, that's very manageable without losing, quality control, culture, and all that stuff. So, but yeah, first off, go online, fill in the application form, and then, next year, there's another, call it 70 sites that's going to go open.
Building a coffee empire one store at a time and ensuring that along the way the community is included in that. That is what the team at Plato are doing with their small business, which I don't know if will be small for much longer. All the best to you and the business. Stefan, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Stefan Bradel, co-founder and CEO at Plato Coffee, joining us to take a look at their business and how they built it. Inspired by the SME of the week? Start your own business or scale up and save up to 50% on fees with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're running a business, you know the sound. That's growth. Another customer. Money in the bank. Why should your business slow down for your bank? With Capitec Business, it doesn't. You get lower fees, faster credit approvals, and bankers who know your business. Now that's progress. Bank on better with Capitec Business Banking. Capitec is an authorized credit provider. FSP 46669. Initiation, service fees, and conditions apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And that's the update for today, folks. That's indeed the update for the week. I'm looking at a television screen. I see Bafana Bafana currently singing our national anthem, which means the match is set to kick off in the next 5.5 or so minutes. From our side, we wish the team all of the best. We're going to cross back to the SAFM team so they can get the latest round of evening news and other communications out before the game so that we don't miss the kickoff. From my side, until next week, good night.